Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Amazon tried to roll out some algorithms to do resume screening internally. And whatever they did, they couldn't get rid of a gender bias that the algorithm was picking up. And they eventually decided not to roll this out. Now, Amazon is a large enough company, has a lot at stake, and did all the tests and realized that there are these biases, and they decided not to roll it out. But who knows? There might be companies that are using these advanced AI that have these biases. And so they are making mistakes as well. So I think we also have to think about, you know, not only in terms of retraining humans, but also these AI have their limitations as well. And so how do we best use them? And when we think about where, you know, these biases and where they come from, at the end of the day, you know, we talked about machine learning and the fact that these AI are mostly learning from data. So they're picking up biases that are in the data. So a recruiting algorithm is trying to figure out, you know, which people to invite for a job interview. And it's looking at decisions made by others in the past. And if there have been biases that humans have had, it picks up those biases and now it institutionalizes the biases and it almost scales their impact because it's making those decisions systematically for millions. And so we have to worry about those issues as well. So I think there's a number of issues. There's a short-term issue around algorithm bias. There's an issue about workforce training. So I think the ramifications are huge. If we select one technology that's going to have a huge impact on society over the next 50 years that we need to prepare for as individuals, as regulators today, then it would be AI.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare.
PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Karthik, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Srini, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually was introduced to you by way of your publicist who sent me a copy of your book, which we will talk about in quite a bit of detail. But before we get to the book, given that you and I are both of Indian descent, I want to ask you, what did your parents do for a living and what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
Yeah, so I had a very middle-class upbringing in India back in the 80s. So my parents were both working professionals. In fact, they were working in state-owned banks. In fact, during that period, all the banks in India were state-owned. So my dad and my mom both worked in banks. And I think in terms of how it affected me, I think, you know, if again, you rewind back to the India of the early 80s, mid 80s, you know, there weren't a whole lot of opportunities. The only way for somebody to get out of that rut was, you know, you had to become an engineer or a doctor and you had to excel academically. So I was a person who was very much interested in, you know, writing and creative things. But, you know, the message all around me at home in school was, wow, you need to study and get better grades if you need to go anywhere in life. So I think eventually at some point in late high school, it kind of had its impact and I changed courses. I changed my approach to everything. So I think it generally that competition, the intensity of the competition, the focus on academics, and this sense of, you know, you'll be stuck in this unless you work hard and get out of it. You know, all of that shapes you in many ways.
Yeah. So I wonder, I know from having read the book and also having read your bio that you do far more than, you know, than just do work as an engineer. You're a professor. You now have written a book. I know that you like making films. I wonder how you maintained your creative spark despite this narrative that was going on all around you.
Well, to be honest, I gave up that creative side of me for a long time. So, you know, at some point I decided, okay, if this is what is expected of me, this is how I earn my respect in society, then, you know, so be it. I'll show them I can play that game too. And so I ended up doing engineering. I did very well in engineering. I went to one of the top engineering schools in India. I did well there. I ended up doing a PhD. I became an academic. I wrote research papers. And then one fine day, it struck me. I'm going to say this was probably around 10, 12 years back. After I got tenure at Wharton, that I had given up this other side of me, another side which was very deep and integral to who I am. And I had kind of, you know, really suppressed it. So I decided that I was no longer going to do that. And so then I enrolled in a filmmaking summer program. And then after that, you know, over the next several years, started spending weekends making short films. I once took a sabbatical from Wharton. And during that time, during my spare time, I was writing a screenplay. I spent some time going to Bollywood, speaking to producers and directors in Bollywood, trying to convince them, hey, you know, this professor can actually direct movies. Put your money in this project. Of course, I couldn't convince them, but I tried anyway. Uh-huh. And then this book also came out of that interest to, or that desire to cater to that creative side. And I said, look, I've done a lot of technical research, but it would be nice to try and write for the masses and write, in a format that would allow me to tap into my creative side. So I tried to write this book in a way where I think lay people can relate to it. And hopefully I've shared some interesting stories and perspectives on AI and algorithmic decision making, which both sound very technical, but which affect all of us. And so the goal of the book was to try and address that topic more creatively.
Yeah, we'll get to the book. I have to ask you about the Bollywood piece because I want to know, one, what was the reaction from people in your life when you said, you know what, I'm going to take a sabbatical from Wharton, this like prestigious business school where I've gotten tenure, where I've probably crossed off all of the checkboxes of society's life plan and basically met every sort of checkbox my Indian parents probably expect of me. What was their reaction and why do you think that more people don't do what you did?
Well, so I'll tell you the reaction. So my wife was very amused and she actually asked me, what's next? Do you want to be a gymnast? And so that was her exact question for me. My dad and I actually have this shared love for books. And so I remember his question for me was, why a movie screenplay? Why don't you write a nonfiction book? And I think it was a very practical suggestion. But I was pretty committed to writing the book. But mostly, I don't think anyone got in the way because at that point, I had done what was expected of me in some ways. And my parents, obviously, at that point were, were willing to support whatever I was doing. So they all had some questions. They all found it unusual. But there were certainly no barriers or roadblocks from the family. In terms of your question of why don't other people do it, so I think it's interesting. I see this a lot with my students. So I do this, you know, walking home office hours with my students. And so one of the things I've gotten into a habit of is every evening I walk back home from campus to my place with a student with me, and we talk about anything they want to talk about, not just my course. And, you know, usually it's entrepreneurs who've got a startup idea, but every once in a while I'll have a student who is, you know, living somebody else's life and, you know, is kind of really struggling with it. And sometimes it's a talk with an alumnus who, you know, 10 years later is kind of asking, you know, why am I still doing this? So I see that, you know, why don't enough people try to take hold of their own narrative? Wow, it's a hard question. I still haven't figured it out. I think it gets to you if you don't. And so either, you know, some people manage to figure out a way to, you know, switch and change directions in a very nonlinear way, and it works out for them. But it's very risky, and others are very scared of it. But I usually, you know, I think that, you know, there are ways to handle that. For example, by making it a hobby and sort of creating time for hobbies, or figuring out where exactly do your personal interests and your professional skills overlap. And for me, again, this book was an example of that, where I, you know, I tried to write that screenplay once. I in fact wrote another screenplay a second time, I know eventually at some point I'll make that movie, but for now, I kind of felt like, hey, this book is a way for me to combine my skill sets with my interests. So I think sometimes it's figuring out those synergies. And, you know, that's where it's more doable. And people, I think, worry about, you know, that there's this really big transition I have to make and there's financial risks and so on. Mostly, I think we're all afraid of risks. I think we are all born to take risks. We take a lot of risks as kids. And then over time, we learn fear. And that fear then runs the narrative for all of us. It runs it for me too. But, you know, periodically, I try and break free from that and try something. So even with startups or with books and with films and so on, it's all been, you know, how do I, you know, cater to that creative side? And, you know, it's not about taking reckless chances, but how do we take calculated risks? Because I think at the end of the day, we have to do that, or you go through life and one fine day, I know we'll regret it if we haven't taken those chances.
Yeah. You know, one thing I wonder is, in these conversations with your students, how do they differ across cultures? Because I'm guessing you probably have a wide range of students, Indians, Asians, Caucasians. Like, how do those conversations tend to differ when you have them across cultures?
Yeah, so I'll preface what I'm going to say by clarifying. So I'm a professor at the Wharton School of Business. So we end up with students who, you know, first of all, academically have excelled. And they're often type A personalities. They're, you know, been chasing these goals. And then they come to Wharton where they're surrounded by others like them. So people who are already competitive get even more competitive. And at the same time, you have, you know, this pressure to perform. And, you know, at some level, none of them or very few of them have asked what is it they really want. And mostly they're kind of just chasing targets. And so they tend to do that. So coming back to your question, you know, how does it differ across different groups of students? So, you know, I think the most common instance of a student saying, you know, I'm doing this, I don't love it, I don't know why I'm doing this, it often comes from, say, an Asian American kid, right? And the story is almost always, you know, my parents wanted me to do this, therefore I'm doing it. Now I'm studying and all my friends are pursuing investment banking because that's the job we want. And therefore I'm doing that too. My parents don't understand why I would give up a Goldman Sachs internship to go do this other things. And so therefore I'm taking up that Goldman Sachs internship. And I think that's the most common sort of problem that I see. But it's not always Asian American kids. I mean, it's most common among them. But, you know, I don't want to present this as that's the typical student. That it's probably, you know, every once in a while I'll have a student who's facing that or going through that. But then there's a lot of students who are there because, you know, they've actually discovered they have a passion for entrepreneurship or business or technology and they're doing that. But then there's also people who have come there sort of following a path that was given to them. And now they're continuing to follow their path that somebody else has given them. But, you know, starting to realize now that you're becoming an adult, you've got to craft your own as well.
So I wonder, both being of Indian descent, having been raised with the narrative about the importance of education, and now you yourself being an educator, I think you and I are probably a little bit far apart in age, but I mean, the world is so different now than it was even when I went to college and when you went to college. And I realize implicit in this question probably is my assumption that the fact that the education system is broken. But, you know, I've had this conversation with Adam Grant. I've had it with Cal Newport. And I wonder, you know, you from the vantage point that you have, what do you think that the future of education is going to look like? What would you tell parents who are listening to this? And if you have kids, what do you give, you know, what advice do you give to them about this?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
I've been known to do that to people.
Especially for an educator, but,
yeah,
you know, again, we have this joke at home. My wife keeps saying, you know, for an educator, you're amazingly skeptical about formal education. And I forget who said this, right? But somebody said, don't let schooling get in the way of your education. And, you know, I'm certainly not that much of a skeptic. But I went to a school in the late 80s, early 90s, where, you know, this was a, you know, first of all, this was India, and these were not progressive schools. They were following a very strict curriculum, strict set of rules. And my school in particular was an extreme within that that type of education. And so we had to wear uniforms. We had to make sure our shoes are polished a certain way. Our shirts were tucked in a certain way. We had our name badge on. And anytime you're not doing one of these things, you get punished for it. You get embarrassed, humiliated almost publicly. You stand outside the school for a few hours. All passersby see you and so on. So it was a very different style of education. And I was actually not even average. You know, throughout middle school and early part of high school, I was kind of like a below average kind of student, middling, nothing exceptional about me. So I struggled in that environment. And then I ended up doing well and did a PhD and all of that, which people find surprising, people who know me from that phase of my life. And mostly it was my FU to society in some ways that, you know, I'll show you I can do this too. And it was that. But it was not because I wanted to. It was mostly trying to prove something to someone. And so I think that was at least my story with regard to education. I know I'm not answering your question, mostly because I don't have an answer to your question. But I think at the end of the day, what I'm trying to say is that we all need to take control of what education means for us. And I think we're today in a very different place, not only in the US, but also, you know, geographically, I'm in a different place, India versus the US, but also a different time. I think education is becoming more progressive. At the same time, education is becoming more flexible. You define what it is for you. Employers are also starting to say that, look, you know, you don't necessarily need that degree for me to take you seriously. So I think it's about excelling now rather than having a certificate that you kind of put in your resume. And I think that certainly means that we now need to figure out what is it that we truly want to excel in and go pursue excellence. And that can be done within a formal framework. And I think that's what that's the role education will play, which is you come in with a set of goals and we provide you the flexibility to go pursue that. I think that's how people have to relate to education. I think for my own kids, you know, they're a bit too small right now. So I'm not like seriously thinking about high school or college education for them. But when I do, I hope the approach I will have is that, you know, I wouldn't care about, you know, hey, I want you to go to this school and get that kind of a degree. But it's more about, you know, understand your personality and understand what you like and what you'll be good at and make good choices and find the kind of educational resources that'll help you excel. I still believe that the degree programs stay, they still are relevant, but in a very different way than they were 20 years back.
So I think that the reason I brought that up, you know, 20 years back, I went to a school, I went to school at Berkeley, which in a lot of ways is like Wharton, filled with overachievers. Mm-hmm. And when I looked back at it, I think the thing that struck me most, and I think, you know, it took 20 years of life experience to have this awareness, is that we had a very clear definition of success. It was, you know, everything you just mentioned, McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, you know, or med school or law school, and not just any med school or law school, like the top that you could possibly get into. And that was kind of it. It was kind of like, these are the options in front of you. If you don't choose them, you're a total screw up. And, you know, I realized I made every decision in college based on what I thought would get me a job. And I realized I totally missed out because of that. And I wonder why you think that is. And, you know, is this more common in elite type schools where, you know, you're at a UPenn or a Harvard, And you know, how do you unwind that? Like, how do you undo that narrative in society? Because, you know, hopefully it doesn't take other people 20 years of life experience to figure that out.
Right. You know, I think people who get into these places, it's not that they walk in as a clean slate and then the environment makes you that. You're almost walking in that, because just to get into these places, it's so competitive. You're competing and you're kind of ticking off or checking off certain boxes and making sure I can get into these schools like Berkeley, Harvard, Penn, and whatever else. And so you're already coming in that way. And now you're surrounded by everyone else who's like you. And then it goes to a whole new level. That competitive streak, that approach of chasing this goal that you don't even know why you want it, but because everyone else is chasing it, you join the race as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that does happen a lot in these places. I think the good news is that, you know, it's no longer that one set of goals. I think, you know, for people who are good at it, who can be, who can pursue academic excellence, who can chase those academic opportunities, excel at these demanding places like a McKinsey or Goldman Sachs, I think it's great. You still can do that. But for people who can, who have something to offer, something valuable to offer to society, to an employer, or, you know, as an entrepreneur, I think now there are all these other opportunities, which is great. The flip side of it, though, is that previously, as you said, there's this one goal that everyone knows and there's something to chase. And you suddenly say there is no finish line, there is no goal. And all of a sudden, I think a lot of people will now struggle to figure out, what am I even supposed to do? And I think while it's going to help unleash a lot of possibilities and potential for a lot of people who struggle under this formal, intense academic goal setting, it also will mean some people will struggle with the lack of clear direction. And so I think we are navigating both of that. But, you know, if we go all the way on this to the other side, then I think, you know, complete lack of structure is going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes hear, you know, kids saying, or even sometimes their parents saying, look, Bill Gates was a dropout, or look, Steve Jobs was a dropout. You know, I don't need this education and so on. Let's be clear. You know, Bill Gates may have been a dropout, but he dropped out of Harvard and he dropped out with a very specific opportunity that he was going to pursue. He didn't just say, I'm going to float around life and see what comes, that happens. So, you know, I think the people sometimes mistake all these successes of dropout success as being a causal relationship that, hey, you can just, you know, get rid of all this structure in your life and then I'll succeed. And it's not that. We all need some structure. Maybe we had too much of it. At least I certainly did, where goals were being set for me and things like that. But I think we all need some structure. So we have to all find some middle ground between the two extremes.
Yeah. So two more questions around this, and I promise we'll get to the book.
I'm enjoying this so much. I know I should talk about the book, and hey, we'll get there.
I promise we'll get there.
No, let's certainly cover this because I'm enjoying it.
You know, there are two things that struck me over the last couple of months, I think particularly because I turned 40, my sister just got married, and these two things have been on my mind, especially after having finished a second book with a publisher and not being under contract to do a third one. I'm guessing you've probably read the book, The Road to Character by David Brooks, or you've probably heard of it. He talks about this distinction between resume values and eulogy values. Mm-hmm. And so many of the things that you and I are talking about, you know, getting into these top schools, working at these top firms like the Googles, the McKinseys, and the Goldman Sachs are all resume values.
Yeah.
So I wonder why you think as a society we have so much emphasis on resume values as opposed to eulogy values.
Well, I think the emphasis on resume values is somewhat natural in a society which is built around constraints and resource constraints in particular. And if the opportunities are few and far between, and, you know, there's, you know, this is a natural human instinct. It's a survival instinct, right? We want food, we want shelter, we want water. And it's so natural in us that if there are some constraints around us and if there's resource constraints, then we want to actually adjust so that we get those resources. And so I think the resume value simply reflects what it takes for us to have the resources we need. But I think we're also shifting to a world that was built around, you know, scarcity mindset, to a new world where at least for, you know, a some section of society and in some countries where, you know, it's no longer this zero-sum game and it's no longer this either you have it or I have it. And if I don't get it, you know, I'm done. I won't have these resources. So I think, you know, as society gets wealthier, as our basic needs are taken care of, I think we start to think about, you know, no longer the resume values, you know, these other values that are more integral and core to us. And you mentioned you just turned 40, and I think that's probably an interesting age where that happens to many of us. For me, and I'm, let's see, I'm 41 right now, so I turned 40 recently as well. And for me, this moment of reckoning came up to some extent a few years back when my dad was diagnosed with terminal cancer and he passed away soon after. And, you know, I think my foundations were shaken. I was questioning almost everything. I was asking, what's the point of all this? Where are we headed? You know, the kinds of questions we hear about, but it's hard to internalize. And you reach a certain stage in your life where you understand the finiteness of your life as a more tangible concept and something you relate to as opposed to a theoretical concept. And for me, when that happened, yes, I was really, you know, starting to question almost everything I did. You know, why am I doing this? What's the end goal? Is it giving me joy? Is it giving me financial stability? What is the point of all of these things? And I realized that a lot of times I'm, you know, chasing these beautiful dreams where at the end of the day, you know, I might not even get there. The analogy I have is, you know, I did this Rhine Valley cruise many years ago. In fact, that was when I proposed to my wife. And we were doing this cruise and there were these beautiful castles on top of these hills every few miles. And you kind of feel like, okay, well, let's get down over here and let's hike up to that castle. And I feel a lot of the goals we have early on in our life are like those castles where we look at it from a distance and it looks so beautiful. But what I've realized over time is that, you know, we hike, we sort of take this road to that beautiful castle. And, you know, often we get lost on the way, we never reach there. Or, you know, maybe we reach there, but we lose all these people who are with us in the journey. And we didn't realize that. Or we get there and finally we reach there and it's like, oh, this castle looks okay. It's not as beautiful or as amazing as I thought it is. It's fine, like any other castle. And our goals are like that. I mean, at the end of the day, we just are so focused on the goals and we adapt to those goals and we go chase those goals and we either don't make it and we make all these sacrifices, or we eventually make it, and it's okay. I mean, the goal was, you know, not as beautiful as we thought it is. And so I think for me, I've kind of been asking myself, I haven't found the answers yet, but been asking myself, you know, how should the goal adapt to the individual rather than how should the individual adapt to the goal, right? And it's a tough set of things we all have to take care of. I wish life were easier, but you know, it isn't.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. When I heard you say that, it reminded me of this quote that I've probably mentioned on the podcast before. Sam Jones is a photographer, and he was interviewing Ed Helms right at the height of his career when The Hangover had just come out, and he was so famous that he was being recognized in the streets everywhere he went. And he said, "How does it feel to be at this point in your career?" He said that life is a series of false horizons.
Mm. Yeah. I think that's a great way to put it. Yeah.
So one more question around this, and then we'll get to the content of the book. We're talking about this idea of measurement and metrics and accolades and achievements. And this has been fresh on my mind because I'm working on an idea for a new book about what it means truly to be successful on your own terms. And part of my research led me back into Clayton Christensen's book, How Will You Measure Your Life? Mm. And I wonder at this point in your life, having reached tenure, having built startups, having written this book, how do you measure your life?
Yeah, it's, wow, you're asking me these tough questions, Srini, making me...
I've been known to do that to people.
Making me peer into my own soul. How do I measure my life so far? I think mostly it's a series of missteps and failed attempts, but the good news is that I have been alert and I've rarely repeated the missteps, and I've learned from each misstep. And I think the one thing that I can say is, you know, I have continued to learn, and I've never had this hubris, this hubris in terms of, you know, who I am or where have I arrived. I'm still learning. I'm still trying to get places. I'm still trying to figure out who I am, where I need to be. So I think in terms of being a learning entity, I think done well. I've had a lot of missteps, of course, along the way. I guess the other piece that in terms of measuring my life, the part where I feel the glass is half full is that I have not let fear dictate everything I do. I think a lot of people do the super safe thing because, you know, fear drives that narrative. And so whether that's meant, like I said, I tried to make the movie, maybe it didn't happen, but I don't regret having spent a lot of time on that. I tried to work on startups, some of them failed, one of them succeeded. But again, I didn't let fear prevent me from trying those things. And mostly, I think in terms of that half full sort of perspective on my life, I think it's the fact that I've been open to learning, the fact that I often take stock and reflect, which has been helpful. And the fact that I've not let fear run the narrative has been helpful. But in the part that's half empty, you know, yeah. So I, you know, for a significant chunk of my life, I chased goals where I didn't even know why I was chasing them. I did it because it was expected of me from society, and I did that. It gives me a certain financial security today, so maybe it's not that bad. But yeah, there have been many missteps along the way too. But that's life, I guess.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's get into the content of the book. Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence. What prompted your interest in this particular subject, and what is it that are the implications of artificial intelligence, not just for the way that we work, which there are many. And I think, you know, what I'm realizing is this is much more prevalent in our lives than most people are even aware of. But what is it? What are the implications of all of this for the future of our lives?
Yeah. By the way, before I answer that question, wow, I came prepared for these kinds of questions in this interview, but you took me to a whole new place. but yeah, coming back to your question, we talked a little bit about why I wrote this book. You know, I've spent a lot of time as part of my research and as part of my work studying how technology and in particular intelligent algorithms drive our decisions, whether as consumers or, you know, whether it's in our workplace. And so I feel that a lot of people, as you suggested, don't fully recognize the kind of impact they're having on our lives. And I wanted to explore that a little bit, what it means, you know, the history of how we arrived there, certain philosophical questions around, what it means to be outsourcing a lot of our decision-making to machines. What does it mean for our humanness or our humanity? And also just certain policy and societal questions around, you know, what are the implications of machines making so many decisions for us? And so that's what I wanted to explore. And, you know, I think most people don't realize that intelligent algorithms and AI, it's running so much of our lives and making so many decisions for us. You know, whether it is what products we buy on Amazon or what media we consume or on Netflix or who we date on something like Tinder, but also very critical decisions. Like you apply for a loan and there's an algorithm that's kind of deciding whether we get the loan or not, or what should be the interest rate that we pay for that loan. Or you apply for a job, increasingly algorithms are doing a lot of resume screening and figuring out which applicants are right for this job. And they're also making life and death decisions for us. You know, in hospitals, doctors are being asked to consult algorithms when it comes to diagnosing diseases, when it comes to making developing treatment plans. In courtrooms in the US, judges and parole officers are asked to consult algorithms that predict a defendant's likelihood of reoffending, and therefore that suggest what should be the right sentence or whether a person should get parole or not. So they're all around us. They're making so many decisions for us and about us. And the implications for society are huge. And that's what I wanted to explore in this.
You know, so one of the things that you said in the book is that in this brave new world, many of our choices are in fact predestined, and all the seemingly small effects that algorithms have on our decisions add up to a transformative impact on our lives. And you put that into the chapter about free will in an algorithmic world. And, you know, many of us who are listening to this probably spend time on Facebook every day. We probably go to Twitter. We probably all use Netflix. You know, how do you have this dichotomy of free will and the fact that algorithms are making so many of decisions? Like, how do we know we're not going to lose our minds or lose our power in this situation?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? So we all are used to seeing, you know, Facebook, I guess, show us news stories and news feeds. You know, Amazon, Netflix, all of these companies, the algorithms show us what products or media we should look at. You know, if you ask people, most people think they have a lot of control in the final decision, that we get all these recommendations, we politely nod at them, and we do what we want. But actually, the data suggests otherwise. So at Amazon, nearly a third of the purchases are driven by algorithmic recommendations. At Netflix, 80% of what we view is driven by recommendations by the Netflix algorithm. So these systems are having a huge impact on our choice, and we don't realize it. And mostly their impact is very positive because, you know, there's so much media on Netflix. Do I want to waste time looking at all the junk until I find the right stuff?
I still find it difficult, even with the recommendations. I'm like, you know, I get to the end of the day, I'm like, okay, you know what? Maybe I should just watch Friday Night Lights again for the 10th time.
Well, I don't know. I actually like the Netflix algorithm, but maybe I'm not as open to watching the same thing for the 10th time. Maybe I'm just a bit more experimental. But yeah, I think we're all different in that sense. But, you know, I think these algorithms at least can help narrow the set of options, focus our attention on a smaller set of more relevant alternatives. And who wouldn't value the productivity gain from that? So I think there's a lot of potential value here. But I think the flip side, of course, is also, you know, when you look at, for example, news being curated by algorithms. You know,
exactly. That's where I wanted to go next. Yeah. That's what was going to be my next question. You read my mind.
Right. So, you know, are we getting exposed to the right set of and the broad set of perspectives or not? Is the algorithm saying, okay, I saw this person likes these kinds of news stories on these topics with these with right leaning or say left leaning, and I'm going to show him or her more of that? Then that could be a problem. So I think the implications are huge. And who are we at the end of the day if we aren't just a sum total of all the choices we've made in terms of what information we consume, what we ate, and things like that? And that's what algorithms want to ultimately drive today. They want to influence, you know, what we buy, what we read, what we eat. And I think that's pretty much us. You know, you add all those decisions, that's you and I too.
So decisions like what to eat, what to wear, what to buy on Amazon, like those don't have sort of ripple effect implications necessarily, like who am I going to vote for? And I only noticed this because, you know, I, based on, just use your imagination, based on the conversation we have, I tend to lean left. I'm an immigrant. I went to Berkeley. And I noticed when I even look at my YouTube recommendations, because I watch it from my Xbox, it's like I started watching Seth Meyers. Pretty soon after that, like all of my YouTube recommendations were Seth Meyers, Stephen Colbert. I was like, wow, everybody in my YouTube recommendations is totally anti-Trump. And I had a friend who told me he specifically goes to read Breitbart News at least once a week just because he wants to figure out what he's missing out on and seeing what are other people being told. So, you know, I mean, aren't there dangerous implications for this too? There's a whole other side to this. And what are those?
Yeah, huge implications. And we've seen it play out, right? I mean, it played out with the 2016 elections where, you know, people were saying, hey, you know, Facebook's algorithms put us in these echo chambers where we saw more and more of what we already know. And people didn't even see where the election was going to, or how it was going to end. There was also the fake news issue, which again was algorithm driven because Facebook initially had human editors who were manually curating the trending news, but they were accused of having a left bias. And so Facebook said, you know, algorithms can't be accused of having a left bias, so let's roll out algorithms. But then the algorithms weren't good at figuring out that a certain story is a fake story and then circulated that. So again, it drives elections. It has a huge impact. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, one interesting story I have here is that back in 2016, it was actually late 2015, early 2016, I came up with a proposal for my book. And the book proposal talked about a couple research studies where Facebook's algorithms was able to influence people's emotions, was able to influence people's decisions to vote or not. So, for example, when they added the I voted button to Facebook, there was a noticeable increase in the number of people who voted. So there were these research studies, and I was talking about that. And in the proposal, I mentioned how it can actually drive and influence election outcomes. And that was my book proposal, which went to agents in the summer of 2016. And I remember one of the agents who read that, and by the time they read it, it was almost like October or November of 2016. And she looked at my proposal and she said, look, you just wrote this book 2 years too late because your entire proposal is built around how it can impact elections. Now that's played out, so you've got to change it and talk about what else is coming next. But it's really interesting, you know, the book proposal talked about this and we saw it play out, and we'll see it play out more and more. I think, a lot of our decisions are going to be driven by technology and by algorithms that are curating our world for us. And so we've all got to take stock and take control. So for me in 2016, like your friend, I decided every day I go to New York Times, but I'm also now go to Fox News and see what's the other perspective over here. And so I try and break out of that filter bubble. And so one of the things I do in the book is really talk about what can we do as individuals, what should regulators do, what should technology companies do so that we, ultimately have control over this narrative of how algorithms and AI and technology shapes us.
Yeah. So we've talked about it from a sort of impact on humanity standpoint. I want to shift gears and talk about it from an impact on work standpoint, because I know that so many people are like, oh, these AIs are going to steal our jobs. And I had a friend who basically did a PhD in machine learning. And I remember one day he kind of explained to me, he said, Srini, this isn't magic. He said, it's not like you can just dream up anything. But he said, anything in your life where you're using data probably can have artificial intelligence applied to it. So my first thought was starting to look at all the things that we did at the Unmistakable Creative that involved data. And the first place I went to was our email newsletter. And I thought, okay, open rates, click-through rates, subscribers. And we actually ended up hiring an AI company that layers on top of MailChimp that does, you know, automated segmentation, make sure we're only engaging with our, most engaged subscribers. And it was mind-boggling how much better the results got in the span of 2 months.
Interesting. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I wonder, what are the implications job-wise and productivity-wise for all of this?
Again, huge implications. I think if you look at what AI today is essentially, as your friend said, today it's mostly what is known as machine learning. And machine learning is the idea of let's analyze a lot of data, figure out patterns, and then, make predictions about the future, right? And so in this case, for you, it was analyze the data on, who's opening emails, who's clicking, and what are they doing, and then make predictions of who will open the next email, who will actually engage, who will ignore it, and so on. And then, of course, those predictions then drive your marketing actions. And of course, you can also apply this to many other settings. And so you can apply it to medicine, and you could ask yourself, can I use data to diagnose diseases? Because at the end of the day, what is a doctor doing? The doctor is looking at a bunch of symptoms and then matching it to past case histories and saying, this looks a lot like that. And therefore, my hypothesis is that this person has pneumonia and not influenza, right? Or something like that. You look at a number of settings. What is a judge doing? Again, they're looking at the data on this particular case, matching it to all, cases that they know of, and saying that this is the best the closest other case, or this is how I can interpret it. It's all, at the end of the day, data and pattern matching and so on. So I think a lot of what we do today is or can be automated for most of us. Again, it'll vary from one industry to the other. There was a machine learning researcher who made this once famous but controversial statement that we should stop training radiologists because everything they can do can be done by machine learning. And I think that statement is a bit extreme, but it kind of demonstrates the approach of a lot of computer scientists and machine learning folks in terms of we can automate this and we can automate that. So a lot of what we do will get automated, but I think at the end of the day, we've got to think about, how do we use this as an augmentation technology, free up our time, and have some of our routine tasks that we waste time on be automated for us so we get more free time. We can end up in one of two situations. Maybe we end up in a situation where, it's hard to employ significant chunks of society. And so then we need to think about social security. Or we end up in a situation where it's a utopia. Machines are doing a lot of what we do, and we all, need to work 2-3 hours a day, and we get the rest of the day to ourselves. Who knows where we'll end up? I think, anything is feasible, but there's no doubt the workplace will look very different. And that's why in the book, I tried not to go into that portion because, it's a speculation of where we'll be 50 years from now, and that's important. But there are ways in which the algorithms are impacting us today, and we're not actually even realizing it or paying attention to that.
Yeah. I've kind of, like I said, I've kind of been amazed at all the various ways that AI has already become a big part of my life, because my research led me down this rabbit hole of all sorts of interesting tools. I found a slide design tool called beautiful.ai that allows you to make breathtaking presentations in minutes. There are a lot of small things that we spend so much time on that I was baffled by, but we're talking a little bit about the sort of implications for what the future of work might look like. I had a presidential candidate, a guy named Andrew Yang here. And we were talking about this, and he said, automation is coming. And I think the thing that's interesting to me about part of what's going to happen with automation is that up until, this sort of next wave of change, every sort of technological shift we've had that automated things displaced blue collar labor. But for the first time in history, we're looking at a potential displacement of white collar labor. And I wonder, like you said, is there a danger that we're going to have mass hysteria because of something like that? Because, blue collar labor has been being displaced forever, but we've never had that with white collar labor.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that, white collar labor is going to be impacted by AI. We just talked about, radiologists, doctors and so on. So, a lot of white collar jobs will also be impacted. I think, we'll all have to retrain. There's no doubt about that. Creativity will start to matter a lot more than it did in the past. We'll also become more efficient. I think, we will be freed from a lot of rote tasks that we have to do today. And so that freedom, having that extra time will allow us to do more interesting things with what we already do at our workplace. But I think, yes, the white collar jobs also will be impacted. But I think, when we think about automation and we're talking about, where we'll be in 50, 100 years, the path, over the next several years is going to dictate how we end up. So, as I mentioned, we could end up in a society where, all of us have something to do and it's, a very efficient time. Maybe we work fewer hours a week, or maybe a few of us are working full time and most of us have nothing to offer because we don't have the skills, and then you need social security and all those other protective nets that governments have to offer. All of that depends on the choices we make over the next few years. And that's also true for we were talking about biases earlier. We can't just assume this the technology that we have is going to make all these decisions, automate a lot of the tasks, and easily displace us, because we're also starting to see that we're going to have some hiccups along the way. I mentioned earlier that there are algorithms that judges can consult, parole officers can consult. There was a story last year that, these algorithms had a race bias. I mentioned earlier that algorithms can do resume screening. There was a story late last year, again, that talked about how Amazon tried to roll out some algorithms to do resume screening internally. And whatever they did, they couldn't get rid of a gender bias that the algorithm was picking up. And they eventually decided not to roll this out. Now, Amazon is a large enough company, has a lot at stake, and did all the tests and realized that there are these biases, and they decided not to roll it out. But who knows? There might be companies that are using these advanced AI that have these biases. And so they are making mistakes as well. So I think we also have to think about, you know, not only in terms of retraining humans, but also these AI have their limitations as well. And so how do we best use them? And when we think about where, you know, these biases and where they come from, at the end of the day, you know, we talked about machine learning and the fact that these AI are mostly learning from data. So they're picking up biases that are in the data. So a recruiting algorithm is trying to figure out, you know, which people to invite for a job interview. And it's looking at decisions made by others in the past. And if there have been biases that humans have had, it picks up those biases and now it institutionalizes the biases and it almost scales their impact because it's making those decisions systematically for millions. And so we have to worry about those issues as well. So I think there's a number of issues. There's a short-term issue around algorithm bias. There's an issue about workforce training. So I think the ramifications are huge. If we select one technology that's going to have a huge impact on society over the next 50 years that we need to prepare for as individuals, as regulators today, then it would be AI.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, I want to finish with two questions to bring us full circle. At this point in your life, having done all the things that you've done, books, you know, tenured professor, what are you still uncertain about and what are you still afraid of?
Well, what am I still afraid of? Well, you're back to the tough questions, huh?
Yep.
Well, you know, what I'm afraid of are a couple of things. I think I'm noticing that, you know, over time we all become more risk averse. We all start to worry more. And I worry that, you know, I might choose the easy, safe path and might not be willing to take on new opportunities, new possibilities, and new ways to define myself, that I might get trapped in the identity I've established of myself and not be able to break free from that identity, especially now I'm 41, you know, and so you want to keep reinventing yourself. So I worry I might not be able to do that. I'm worried that I might take the easy path. So yeah, I think that's what worries me the most, that I become dictated by my past decisions and not be open to new ones.
Yeah. Well, I want to finish with one final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
What makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Yeah.
I think it's authenticity. I think when you figure out who you are and you don't need to be somebody else and you don't need to have a facade around yourself, I think that's when I think of that person as unmistakable.
Ah, amazing. Well, this has been really, really mind-blowingly cool and thought-provoking and insightful, as I expected it would be. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else that you're up to?
Yeah, so I enjoyed this a lot too, and it was thought-provoking for me too. Thank you for those great questions. Now, you know, I'm probably going to spend the rest of my day reassessing a lot of things about my life. but yeah, where can people find out more about myself? My website is www.hosanagar.com. That's HOSANAGAR. So www.hosanagar.com. On Twitter, I'm K Hosanagar. And my book is called A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence. You'll find it on Amazon and most other bookstores. Yeah, so it's easy to find me on the web and easy to find my book and my writing on the web as well.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating,
inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming. Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.